Okay, good evening, everybody. Plenty of juice, Chris. I'll have to whisper. Welcome to Buddhism in a Nutshell. This is session 5. This is our last class. Can you believe it? Do we have anybody here for the first time? It's okay. You'll be okay. This Buddhism in a Nutshell is a 5-week class, but it's really basic concepts, and so we kind of dip in and out, and we'll do a review. Did you all get that? There's a little welcome booklet. If you didn't get it, then on your way out in the brochure rack there, grab one of those welcome little pamphlets, because it explains some of the things here at the Kadampa Center and some just basic things that might be helpful for your next visit, okay? All right. Since this is our last class, we're going to try to get through as much as possible. We'll do a little bit of a review and a little bit of a discussion about the three principal aspects of the path. I want to have a little bit of time at the end to do a full review and to explain possible next steps for you. And I also want to take time when we start, because we always start this class with a brief meditation, and I was trying to squeeze in a longer analytical meditation last time, so we're going to start with that. But before we do, I wanted to find out briefly, did anybody wake up Wednesday morning and go, I only have until 6 o'clock? Did anybody try that little exercise? And how did that work for you?
But it was kind of like looking through at everything in a different light and really valuing what was important and what
was happening. For those of you that weren't here last week, one of the exercises that we did is we told everybody that tomorrow when you wake up, the first thing that we wanted you to think was, this is your last day. You have until 6 p.m. and then you're going to die. And so what would you do in that day, and how different would you act during that time? Now, we still live in the world. We still have to work. We still have to pay our bills, all that kind of stuff. But having that different perspective would probably make you act a little bit different in your day. So that's part of the concepts, and that's part of that different way of looking at things that we try to share here. Well, what I'd like to do is I'd like to start with, instead of the brief meditation that we normally do, I'd like to do a little bit of a longer meditation. And this meditation, this is called equanimity. And this is actually one of my all-time favorite meditations to do. I still do this quite frequently because it's a very good reminder of a lot of different things. And this will lead us into some of the other concepts that we'll be talking about tonight. So, get yourself in a comfortable position. For those of you that haven't meditated before, we have a 7-point meditation posture that we've been working on, and I'll go through it very briefly for you. It's, if you're sitting in a chair, you might want to have a cushion to put your feet on, because you want your feet to be flat on the ground. So your legs, if you're sitting on the mats or cushions, whether you're in a full lotus position, half lotus, cross-legged, whatever works for you. It's more about being comfortable and creating a solid foundation, a solid base to be able to hold a meditation position for a while. Then you have your back is straight, kind of what we call a regal position with your shoulders back. That increases your lung capacity, helps you to breathe a little bit. Your arms, kind of a little bit out from your body. You can have your hands on your knees or your legs, or you can put them I'm going to answer this question. We put our right hand on our left, and it creates kind of a teardrop shape, and we hold this just slightly below our navel, and it stands for wisdom and compassion, and it's the two wings of enlightenment. I had meant to answer that question the other day, and I didn't, so there you go. But we hold that, our hands just briefly below our navel. Shoulders back, head is slightly tilted forward. It's not too far up, it's not too far down. You don't want to be drowsy, and you don't want to be too distracted. So I try to think of it as a little bit of a string being pulled at the crown of my head that pulls my back straight and elongates my neck. Your eyes are either slightly closed or they're just looking just a few feet out in front of you. And again, you're not really looking at anything. Your gaze is really looking more inward. But if you are going to get too drowsy, you don't want to have your eyes closed. Your lips, your jaw, you're not clenching your teeth, but your tongue is on the roof of your mouth, just behind your teeth on the upper palate, and your jaw is just kind of comfortably closed. Okay, so that's the 7-point meditation posture. And again, this is more about holding a good steady posture that you can keep for a long period of time rather than anything religious or holy. Okay, so just take a minute. Focus your attention on your breath and use one of the various breathing meditations, whether counting the breaths or the 9-round breathing or mindfulness meditations, anything that we've done here or that you may know, to settle the mind into the moment and into a more concentrated state. Sit comfortably and generate the strong intention to do this meditation in order to overcome self-centered bias and judgments and to develop the mind of perfect equanimity and balance toward others. Now imagine in the space in front of you, all right? Imagine in front of you is a total white space. There's nothing there, okay? And in front of you, three people are going to walk into that white space. The first person is somebody that you like. I want you to imagine somebody that you like, somebody that you care for, walking into that space and turning and looking at you. Okay, the second person is somebody that you don't really know, somebody that you're just indifferent toward. Okay, somebody that you've seen at the store, the post office, just somebody that you don't really know. And they just walk in and they walk into the middle. The third person, somebody that walks into that white space, is somebody that you do not like, somebody that you dislike. So in this white space, you've got three people there. You've got somebody that you care for, somebody you like. You've got somebody that you're just indifferent toward, you don't really know. And you've got somebody that you really don't like. Keep those three images in your mind throughout this whole meditation. Okay, first, focus on your friend. Focus on that person that you care for and that you like. And allow your feelings for that person to arise strongly. Feel your conviction that this person is definitely and truly a friend, that is, a person who is good to you, fulfills your needs and wishes. Also feel how you really want this person to be happy and identify yourself with these good feelings. Think about these. Just sit with these good feelings, how you care for this person and you think this person cares for you. Now shift your attention from that person. Shift your attention to the person you don't like, your enemy. This person that you dislike, who's not kind to you, who doesn't satisfy your needs, who annoys you, makes you angry, who hurts you. And look at this person carefully. Look at the feelings that you have about this person. Stay there. Feel those feelings of anger or frustration that you have. Finally, shift your attention to this so-called stranger, this person that you just barely know, but you don't like or dislike. You don't really know this person at all. And look carefully at that person and note the feelings of indifference. Now consider and recognize that the nature of your relationships with each of these three people and the labels that you've put on each of them These labels are based solely on what they do or don't do for you at this point in time. Think of people who have been your friend and then became your enemy, and vice versa. Or think of strangers who have become friends or enemies. Each of these labels is temporary and impermanent. It's just what the situation is at that current time. Now move your attention back to your friend. Imagine a situation that would cause that friendship to end. Imagine a situation that your friend turns against you and experience that resentment, anger, and hurt that you would feel in such a situation. Do you still feel warm, friendly feelings toward this person? Do you still wish him or her well and want that person to be happy? Where's your friend now? And remember, this person was not your friend before you were acquainted. Recognize how easily this person could cease to be your friend now, just as you just imagined. Think to yourself that there's no sound reason for feeling kind and loving toward only that friend at this moment. Relationships have changed in the past and will continue to change. Today's friend can become tomorrow's enemy. Now move your attention to the present enemy, that person in your mind, that third person in the white. Imagine a situation in which you could be drawn together and become close, a common interest or a word of praise or kindness. Look at that person and your feelings toward them very carefully. Are your feelings softening at all? Becoming warmer? You can learn to feel warmly toward your enemies. This has happened before and it will happen again. Why do we hold so strongly to the concept that this person is definitely an enemy? Now move your attention to the stranger. Imagine how one act of kindness or anger from that person could immediately turn him or her into a friend or an enemy, just that quickly. There is no inherent definite stranger here. There's no sound reason for the feelings of indifference that we hold on to. Remember that your present friend and your present enemy were both strangers to you at one time. And this enemy could become a friend or an enemy now. Maintain your awareness of these three people in front of you. Think about the fragile impermanence of these relationships. It is only your misconceived belief in the concreteness of these labels of friend, enemy, and stranger that holds your mind back from the possibility of change and fluidity. Your friend, enemy, and stranger all want happiness just as much as you do. In this respect, we're all equal. Also, everyone is equal in having the potential to develop their minds to the fullest extent and to achieve ultimate clarity and compassion. The differences that we see in people are superficial. They're based only on our mistaken and narrow self-centered views. In fact, everyone is equal in deserving our care and compassion. None of this means that we should not discriminate at all. On a practical level, our ability to distinguish between actions and individuals is necessary. Naturally, we feel closer to some people who are, and it's wiser to keep our distance from others. This is not in any way contradictory to the meditation. The point of this meditation is to develop equal concern, equal regard for everyone, for their well-being, whether they help or harm us at this point in time, and to see that the labels that we put on others are often arbitrary, mistaken, and very changeable. finally, dedicate your positive energy and insights to the well-being and happiness of all living beings. Bring your attention back to the room. That's an equanimity meditation, and you'll see that in a few different forms, a few different ways, and you can do it with different things, okay? But that is actually a meditation that works incredibly well. I have a personal experience. One of the first times that I ever did that particular meditation, I had to call a vendor one time that was just frustrating me no end. I'd had probably about a year of really bad times with this vendor. And I had to call in with the client. I had no choice. I had to work with this man again. And I was really struggling with it. And I'd been working and meditating for quite some time. And this meditation came to mind. And I actually sat down and I meditated. And I brought my husband as the person I loved and cared for, the post office lady as the stranger, and then this vendor whom I really, I mean, detested is probably a pretty strong word for me, but I had a lot of problems with him. And so I did this very meditation for probably about half an hour, 45 minutes before I picked up that phone. And when I finally did pick up the phone and I called him, and I had just done this meditation, and all of a sudden, the whole relationship changed. Everything changed. He was wonderful to work with. I had no problems during the entire phone call or any of the work afterwards, and the only thing that had changed was me, was my voice, my tone. And it's from that moment on, I've been sold on this meditation. I do it all the time. Anytime I have difficulties, this works for me, and I recommend you looking at this one further because it's one that really, really, really will work. Now, from a Buddhist point of view, equanimity, I want you to broaden this out just a little bit. Because we did it thinking about people, okay, strangers, enemies, friends. From a Buddhist point of view, broaden it out and think about all sentient beings, okay, that all sentient beings, all they want is to be happy too, whether they're an animal, whether they're an insect, that we all have these instincts for happiness. So just take a minute and think about that to broaden that out a little bit. All right. I got to watch the time because we're going to go through a lot here. Since this is the last class, I'd like to do a little bit of review, and then we're going to get into some of the bigger concepts and try to spend a little bit of time with emptiness, because that's probably one of the biggest Buddhist concepts that everybody seems to have. Either they say they have trouble with or maybe have a little bit of a misperception on it. So let's go through just a little brief review, and then we're going to write some other things down. Okay, at the last class, we talked about the preciousness of human rebirth, all right, and why. This is when we were getting into that little exercise about what if you only had a day left? Would you act differently? What would you do with your time? And why? Who can tell me why the Buddhist talk of precious human rebirth? Do you guys remember when we were talking about that, why it's so special and precious? It's going to take a while to get warmed up again, isn't it? Okay, Kristen. For those of you that are new, we use the mic because we do record these classes for audio so people can hear them later, and it helps us all to hear.
It's it's precious because it's very difficult, and it's rare to be a human being. It's rare to be that.
Yep.
In the universe.
It is very rare out of all of the beings, all of the sentient beings, all of the things that we can't even think about or see, for us to be born as a human, and not only born as a human, okay, but precious human. That means that we have been given the gifts of the ability to have time with the Dharma. We weren't born in a war-torn nation. We weren't born with any mental difficulties, we have the ability to learn and to study the Dharma. Okay? So that's what makes our precious human life possible. That's what makes it special. Because just to be born as a human might not be able to. Those that are in Tibet right now, okay, even to have a picture of the Dalai Lama, they could be going to jail for that. Those that are in Syria, they're just looking to survive, let alone try to find enlightenment. Okay, we have the time, we have the wherewithal, and we have the teachers too that are here. So this is why the precious human rebirth is so very, very special. We talked a little bit about the Buddhist view of death. The fact that since we believe in rebirth, okay, that we actually study it, that we have death meditations, so you learn not to be afraid of it, okay, and that it can actually be a tool to help you to have a little bit more control over what your potential next rebirth might be, okay? So the Buddhist view of death is much different than what we have here in the West, all right? And it's because of this thought of rebirth and the ability to be able to take a little bit more control over what's going on and what our future could be. Okay, in many ways, the way that we look at it, and I always love this analogy, and I've heard this from a few people, but Scott says it really, really well. You know how, as an environmentalist, we care for this earth, and we want to take care of this earth, and we want to pass it on to those coming behind us. Okay, we tend to think of our minds in that same way. We are the bearer, we are the carrier of this subtle mind, and we want to take care of it so we can pass it on and do a good job so that the next bearer will have that much of a leg up. It's that same concept of that. Okay? We talked briefly about the three scopes. I'll get to that in a minute. But what we're going to talk about tonight a little bit in more depth is the three principal aspects of the path. If you remember, we talked already about renunciation and bodhicitta. Okay? Just go right there. And renunciation, okay, is the state of mind not having the slightest attraction to samsaric pleasures for even a second and having the strong wish for liberation. Okay, this does not mean, if you remember, this does not mean that we have to give up all of our possessions or that we are not supposed to have any fun anymore. Okay, that is not it at all. Sound familiar? Okay, we're talking about giving up attachment to these things. And who remembers what attachment was? Because we talked in some depth about attachment. No, that's okay. Okay. Attachment is when we take... Anybody? Yeah?
Is there a specific answer from last week?
Well, you go for it.
What
is attachment?
Well,
what are we talking
about? I think for us, attachment is... when we were talking about if you're attached to something because you think that's what makes you happy or that's what gives you emotion over just you doing it for yourself instead of the objects or... I mean, you can have attachment to people. You can have attachment to... I guess you could have attachment to emotions as well.
And what are we doing when we have that attachment?
Kind of relying on it, maybe?
Maybe. We're exaggerating the positive qualities. Okay, attachment means we are exaggerating the positive qualities. That chocolate cake is the best chocolate cake in the world. We're exaggerating. I think in Western terms, we talk about those rose-colored glasses, that we're not really seeing it. Okay, so attachment is really exaggerating those positive qualities. Okay, or the same thing can be to be exaggerating the aversion to it. So it's over exaggerating what these qualities are and grasping onto these things. Yes.
I think of attachment almost, I think of it in different analogies, but I think of it as, one, like being wrapped up in the eye of that tornado and just spinning and spinning and spinning and spinning and spinning.
Mm-hmm.
and you cannot stop. You get wrapped up in it. No matter how much stuff flies out of that tornado, you're stuck in that tornado. Or it's like a dog chasing its tail round and round and round, thinking it's going to bite its tail, and it never does. Or if it does, it's a quick nip, and then he keeps doing it again and again and again. In my life, when I think of attachment, I think of being attached to behaviors, emotions, feelings that are of no benefit to me. For probably last long time now, I look at attachment as familiar behavior. Behavior of familiarity. Things I'm attached to that I believe are going to bring me self-satisfaction. And so if I want that piece of chocolate cake, I believe that's going to satisfy me. That's what's going to satisfy me. And not going within myself to find that beauty and that peace within myself and sitting in the emptiness and that stillness.
Son? Scott?
Yeah, there's a lot of ways to look at this, and a lot of times what we do is relate it to, you know, what we've experienced in our personal lives, and that can be helpful. But, you know, a lot of what we do here is we look at, Buddhism has very specific definitions for a lot of things, which gets really interesting.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, these, and it's like Geshe Gelug, our resident teacher, says, you know, when he's talking about these things, he says, I didn't make this up last night. You know, so what he's doing is telling us what he's studied, what's been taught for 2,500 years, you know. And I think there's one really interesting analogy that he uses. And this is his way of taking these teachings in Tibetan and Sanskrit and explaining them in ways that are easy to understand. But there's an analogy that's used in Buddhism for attachment where it's based on the way that they, in India, they catch monkeys, or I guess different parts of Asia, they use this trick to catch monkeys. So what they'll do is they'll take a coconut, and they'll tie a rope around it and stake it down in a field. And they put a hole in the coconut that's big enough for a monkey to stick his hand in, but it's too small for the monkey to pull his fist out. And they'll put something really sweet in there, like some kind of, you know, I don't know, some kind of food in there. So a monkey will come along and put his hand in the coconut, grab onto the food, and is trapped because he won't let it go. And he'll sit there until somebody comes along and grabs him and throws a net or a bag over him because he won't let that food go. So this is really, and I think it helps me when Geshe Gelug explains it this way, to understand the difference between just enjoying things and that it's okay to enjoy things, you know. If you were that monkey, it would be totally fine for you to just sit there and eat the food and, you know, stick your finger in and pull a little out and eat it. And then if, you know, something dangerous came along, you would leave. But the fact that we grab onto things that we don't want to let go. And that's really the feeling of attachment. It's when some of the things are really obvious. I could tell you lots of things I'm attached to, like chocolate and coffee. And you can see it very obviously. But it becomes interesting when you look at these other things in our lives that we don't think of ourselves as being attached to. And yet you get in that situation where you're not going to have it anymore. And it's that feeling that arises inside you that you don't want to let it go. And so that's really, it's that feeling itself. It's not the thing. It's not the enjoyment of the thing. But it's that really tight feeling inside of not wanting to let it go. And that's attachment. And that's the way, one of the traditional ways it's explained in Buddhism. And I have a really funny thing to add. And one reason why I really like this story is because I have a friend, my friend Catherine told me one time this story about how when she was a little girl, she stuck her hand up in a gumball machine to get a gumball out and grabbed onto a gumball. And she wouldn't let it go until the guy at the store promised to give her two if she let it go. I told her this story about the coconut. She said, oh, yeah, you know what happened to me? So anyway, just wanted to share.
The same thing. And it's true. And the monkeys, the funny thing is, the second that net comes on them, or the second that somebody grabs them, they let go. But it's too late. It's really weird. Check it out. Go on YouTube. I've seen it. But that's what we're talking about with renunciation, okay? And that's the first principal aspect of the path, okay? The second principal aspect is bodhicitta, okay? Now, I'm already cheating, so I can't ask you what we meant by bodhicitta, but that is the mind that wishes that the principal mind or the consciousness that combines the two factors of wishing to free all beings from suffering and wishing to attain enlightenment because of that. Okay, so you have to become enlightened. You have to have that wisdom before you can help somebody else. But the reason that you're wanting to become enlightened is so that you can help somebody else, so that you can help everybody else, so you can help every other sentient being. Okay? That's bodhicitta. Okay? A bodhisattva is someone who has that mind. Okay? This is one of those things that we're working on. Okay? Especially in the Mahayana tradition, which is the tradition that we practice in here. All right? It's that mind that wishes to save all others, and therefore that's why we are trying to become enlightened. Okay? When we talk about becoming enlightened, we talk about practicing, and we talk about working on those perfections that we're talking about. We're talking about generosity, morality, patience, joyful effort, concentration, and wisdom. You'll hear all of these things mentioned quite often. Which I'm trying to just kind of go through some of the things that you're going to hear and see if you continue on in some of these interests in Buddhist studies. Okay? And again, like Scott was saying, Buddhism has very definite definitions for things, okay, that are quite different. Sometimes they're quite different from what our Western definitions of these words are. So compassion is the sincere wish that others be free from suffering and its causes. Okay? And love is the wish that others have happiness and its causes. So that's the difference, because they're really quite closely related. But compassion is to want to take the suffering away from others, and love is to want others to be happy. Okay? Equanimity. This is what we just did. This is that meditation that we just did. The actual definition is the absence of the usual discrimination of sentient beings into friend, enemy, and stranger. Okay? Deriving from the realization that all beings are equal in wanting happiness and not wanting suffering. And since beginningless time, all beings have been all things to each other. And this is the basis. This equanimity is the basis for love and compassion. Okay, for true love and compassion to all sentient beings, we really have to understand equanimity, and we have to work toward this. Okay, that whole thing of here's a friend, here's an enemy, here's a stranger. You have to try to lose that enemy. All right, that ick that you have for that person or that insect. If you have to see that all they want is to be happy too. Everybody in this room, that's all we want. That's something that we can all hit common ground on. We all just want to be happy. All right? Now just push that out a little bit. Don't you think that everybody in Raleigh, you know, everybody just wants to be happy, really, bottom line? Okay, and you could take that all the way out. All right? You could take it to all the animals. They just want to be happy. They don't want to suffer. They don't want to be hurt. They just want to be happy. Every living thing. Every sentient being. And that's something that equalizes every one of us. So if we just try to work with that a little bit. And when it talks here, deriving, since beginningless time, all beings have been all things to each other. This is another one of those Buddhist concepts that since we have been here, or these minds, okay, have been around since beginningless time, we have all been all things to each other. Okay, what that's trying to say is that at one point, every single one of us has been each other's mother, father, child, enemy, friend. We have been all of these things to each other, okay? So that's another interesting concept, to try to really think about that. So, and one of the two teachers that have kind of founded our organization that we belong in, the FPMT, Lama Yeshe and Lama Zopa Rinpoche. Lama Yeshe always calls everybody, he passed away now, but he always called everybody dear. And he always thought of them, of everybody else, of having been his mother, because that's how he was really able to do this equanimity in his mind, that everybody was his mother at one time. So he tried to treat everybody like that. Okay, think about Mother Teresa. She does that. She did that with all of these children and all of these people that she helped in Calcutta. She had that perfect equanimity. She didn't see that suffering the way that we do, and she just had that perfect equanimity. Okay, so that is equanimity, and these all are just so tightly woven. Okay, so this all goes together, and this is where some of the stuff is going to go. All right. Make sure that we get all of this stuff. All right. Now, we're going to get into some of these other things. A little bit later, if we have time, I'm prioritizing because we always run out of time. If we have time, I want to walk you through one of the basic Buddhist prayers that we have here, the foundation of all good qualities. If we run out of time, okay, it'll be up on the Kadampa Center website, okay, and you can run through it yourself and think about it because it's all the concepts that we've talked about. It's a lot of the words that we've talked about. So if we run out of time, you can go to the Kadampa Center website under Spiritual Programs, Buddhism in a Nutshell, and then I'll try to remember to put it up as a PDF if it's not there already. All right, watch for it in the next couple of days because it is a basic prayer that we work with here. You can also do it as what we call a glance meditation. And what it is when you read it, you're covering all of the different concepts and all of the different thought processes that we go through to help us on this path to enlightenment, all right? One of the words that we really didn't talk about yet is the word guru, all right? When we hear the word guru here in the West, okay, we tend to think of, oh, no, we're in a cult, or, you know, we're all drinking Kool-Aid, or all of these weird things because we have just different perceptions of things and different thoughts of the way that we think about teachers or the way that we think about some of these words, okay? The word guru actually means heavy with knowledge of the Dharma, a spiritual guide or a teacher, and one who shows a disciple the path to liberation and enlightenment. So guru, lama can kind of be used interchangeably. And in Buddhism, if you were considering choosing a guru, all right, there is recommendations that you study this person for up to 10 to 12 years. All right, you don't just pick somebody and go with them. Here in the West, I mean, we'll just go to a college, we'll pick a teacher, and we'll be done. They have a different concept of that word teacher than we do. Okay, so a teacher or guru to Easterners and to people from India or Tibet, Nepal, it's a totally different thing. There are qualities, and you can research this for yourself. There's 10 basic qualities that a teacher must have that you should be looking for, okay? And then there's like 20-something more. Again, Tibet, especially Tibetan Buddhist, is all about lists, okay? But they must have these qualities, and you have to check them out. You're not just drinking the Kool-Aid. You want to find out if they have all of these specific qualities that you need in a teacher or a guru before you're going to accept them as your teacher. And you watch them and you see if they live by these. Okay, so it's quite a process. But now flip the coin over. If you want to be a student, we have to have specific qualities too. And there's a list of those qualities too before you are going to be ready or we are going to be ready to be accepted as students. All right, and you can look these qualities up, okay? They're just basic, okay? Some are common sense and some are pretty deep. But it's really important to understand the distinction. Geshe Gelug Choda, who is our resident teacher here, he's very careful the way he talks about himself with all of the students and all of the people that come here. He talks about himself as a Dharma friend because he wants to make sure in his mind that he's coming at this from a Western point of view, so that from the Western students and the Western people that are coming to the center, that's a different relationship. It's still a good, very positive one, but it's definitely a different relationship than the guru-student relationship that you'll find if you start studying Buddhism a little bit deeply. Okay, so when you look at the foundation of all good qualities, if you look at that that prayer, that if we've got time we'll talk about, it'll be talking about why a guru is so important and why that's so special. And the best way that I can explain that is we can read books, okay, especially all of us here. We read books, we can study, we can do all of this stuff, and we can gain that knowledge, okay? The Buddhist teacher, the guru, can actually help us to understand it better and help us to try to work into experiential knowledge. So we just don't have the intellectual knowledge, but you have that awareness, or what I call those aha moments. All of a sudden, oh, and they'll understand it. And it just is so much different than when you have a real teacher, when you have a coach, you know, all of a sudden they can help you to understand deeper things. All right? And it's a much better, easier, faster, and more realistic way to gain this knowledge than just trying to read it on your own. Okay, so I think that's about the best explanation. Scott, is there anything else you can think of for just to have that type of understanding, especially if we have a whole six-week class on the spiritual guide here as part of the Discovering Buddhism. Okay, I just did it in like 8 minutes. All right, there's a 5 to 6 week course on this. So it's pretty deep.
Yep. And it is really important to understand, and that's why we mentioned, even though we don't have a lot of time to get into it, we do mention it in this class because it's an extremely important relationship in Tibetan Buddhism. And I think the best analogy that I can see for that we're used to in the West is someone who's in business and you would have a mentor, right? You know, if you were starting out as a real estate agent, you know, and you might have the guy that runs the coffee shop that you go to every morning who's had his own business for, you know, 30 years, and he has us all this really good advice, you know, practical advice about being in business, and, you know, you listen to some things he says, and it's really good and really helpful. But then you have this very seasoned real estate investor who has their own brokerage, you know, and everything, and that person that you look to as your mentor in that career that, you know, that's decided to take you under her wing and is going to help you out, and that's the person that you're going to call and go to when you really have a serious question, when you have a tough decision to make. You know, you're not going to go to the guy in the coffee shop, even though he gives you great advice about business. He's not the guy you're going to go to when you really need advice, when you really need to understand something. So we use that, you know, we have these concepts in the West, like a mentor or like a coach. You know, if you look at the way a great athlete views their coach, you know, that's a really good way to understand that very special relationship between a student and a teacher or a guru in Tibetan Buddhism. And it is, you know, if you do decide to study Buddhism, you know, in detail, it's something you definitely want to spend more time understanding because it is considered very important. But we do have that kind of, well, guru, what do you mean? It's a very strange connotation, I think, to a lot of us in the West. But so it is helpful to understand how the relationship's actually viewed.
Okay, any questions on the guru? All right, now, let's get into emptiness, all right? As we talked about the three principal aspects of the path, renunciation, bodhicitta, and the wisdom of emptiness, the wisdom of seeing reality, all right? As we talk about this, again, there are six-week courses that we have here at the center that will focus on this. And emptiness is also one of those Buddhist concepts that people take years to study. I'm still studying it, okay? But few rules, okay? Number one, emptiness does not mean nothingness, all right? So we're going to keep coming back to this because everybody tends to go to the deep end of the pool, throw the baby out with the bathwater, all of that. So visual aids. Just because I want you to really put this in your mind. Okay. In this bin, I have a pen. I have a meditation bell. And let's put a flower in here. Okay. Do I have stuff in here? Mm-hmm. I've taken the flower out. Is the bin empty? But I could actually say that the bin is empty of flour, couldn't I? We just don't talk that way. But the bin is empty of flour, okay? But there's still stuff in the bin, right? So everybody understands emptiness does not mean nothingness. There's still stuff there, okay? That's really one of those silly things that are kind of hard. I'm going to do some reading, and then we'll do some talking about this, because this is one of those subjects that I want to get the concepts right, and there's no reason for me to struggle with words when they've been stated so very, very well, okay? Compassion and wisdom are the second and third of the three principal aspects of the path, and just like the bird needs two wings to fly, we need both compassion and wisdom to reach enlightenment. And emptiness means the absence or lack of true existence. Ultimately, every phenomenon is empty of existing truly or from its own side or independently. We're going to work on this a little bit. Okay? Many people describe emptiness as a difficult topic, and like other things we've discussed, it's not easy to understand, but it is very interesting. And it can be very helpful to set aside existing connotations we associate with the word emptiness in English. Okay, true or inherent existence is also described as intrinsic reality, concrete, independent existence, or existing from its own side. You hear this language a lot in Buddhism. All right? It is a quality that we instinctively project on ourselves and everything we experience. The belief that things exist from their own side, independent of parts, causes and conditions, or our own mind experiencing them. Okay? Through Buddhist teachings and practice, we seek to overcome this false belief and to ultimately develop the Buddhist teachings, or ultimately develop the ability to see things as they actually exist. Okay, I'm going to take a couple of excerpts from Amy Miller. Venerable Amy Miller is a teacher that she lives up in Virginia, Vermont. And she comes down here and teaches, and she's the one that helped to lay out the course, Buddhism in a Nutshell. I'm going to take a couple of excerpts from her book. And if you want to, again, it's that the green one that's out there, Buddhism in a Nutshell, the last chapter, Insight into the Nature of Reality. What does the term emptiness mean? According to Tibetan Buddhism, emptiness refers to an absence of inherent existence. What is inherent existence? Inherent existence is a quality that we instinctively project onto ourselves and everything we experience. We see things as solidly, concretely existing from their own side, in and of themselves, by way of their own nature, independent of causes and conditions, parts, or our own mind experiencing them. Our projection of inherent existence is completely unconscious and very subtle. In fact, we don't think it is a projection at all. We think that when we perceive an object, the object itself is presenting itself to us instead of the other way around. Once we understand what we're doing, what projecting an inherently existent object means experientially, then we're on our way to understanding and realizing emptiness. Okay, lots of words. All right, things and ourselves do not exist the way that they appear. And this is the source of all of our suffering. This is where we're starting from. Okay? All right. I've been thinking about this. Okay, what is this? All right. Tell me, when does it stop being a flower? Tell me. It's still a flower? To you guys, it's still a flower? Now it's a pile of flower? Okay, it's a flower of parts. Everything consists of parts, okay? The stem, the petals, the stamens, you know, the little seeds. Flower consists of parts, okay? Everything consists of parts, okay? There's no such thing as a partless part, okay? Everything. We are parts, all right? So everything exists by parts, okay? We also exist by conditions, causes, and conditions. This flower couldn't grow without sunlight and soil and water. Okay, those are the causes and conditions. This flower doesn't exist the way that we see it, okay, or the way that we think it does, all right, because it doesn't come from its own side. It doesn't really exist from its own side. It's got parts, it's got causes and conditions, and it's got our mind that is labeling it, okay? Without those things, it doesn't exist. And I know it's really that simple. It's that simple and it's that hard. Okay? So that's where we're going to be starting from. Okay? All of our intentions, all of our interactions are tainted by this trust and that hallucination that it's coming from its own side. There is nothing that independently exists from its own side. These are a couple of the other words that we're going to work on. Okay? Emptiness does not mean nothingness. Okay, we're going to talk about everything exists independence. Is that A-N or E-N? Independence.
right.
Yeah. Everything is in dependence. It all depends on causes and conditions and parts and a labeling mind. Okay? There is nothing that is independently existing. Big difference, independently. This is one of those things that everybody seems to get caught on sometimes. Independently existing doesn't happen. It is all independence. It exists independence on parts, causes and conditions, and you'll hear this said different ways, a labeling mind, okay, cognizing mind, all right, something that puts a label, okay, your mind conceives it, okay, and if we can work with this and understand this, this is where all of this, they say, the suffering comes from. So if we can work with this and understand that there's nothing that's independently existing out there, everything's a projection that we're putting out there. And we can control that. Is this somewhere in there? A little bit, maybe? Yeah? Blank. Okay. All right. In order to understand happiness correctly, it's important to understand that things do exist. It's just not in the way that they appear to us. All right? Sitting here, okay, Sandy, white woman, American, North Carolinian, you know, older lady. Think labels, 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 labels. These are all labels, okay? But you know what? My sister could walk in this door, and she would call me something completely other than Sandy. All right, but you all know me as Sandy, okay? What's that word you use? Emu, right? Ebu, ebu, okay? So Scott says the word ebu, and we're all sitting here going, it means nothing. It means nothing to us, okay? And in actuality, what is that word? It's mother. In what's that? In Indonesia, ebu means mother. All of a sudden, oh, now we all know it. Now if we said the word mother, ibu, we'd get it because now we put something with that. Okay? We understand it. Okay? If, what's a good way to put this? If it was inherently existing, then everybody in this room would have understood the word ibu right off the bat. Okay? If that was actually inherently existent, then we would all know what everything is all the time, okay, if it's actually there, okay, for us, okay, this board, okay, we see it as a whiteboard that we can write on. Any other mind, if that's really inherently existent from its own side, then that would be the same thing to everybody that sees it, every sentient mind that would see that. If it was existing from its own side, every sentient mind would see the same thing. Okay, but you know what? An ant is going to see a big obstacle. Okay, a dog is going to see something to chew on. A child is going to see something to play with. Okay, somebody who's, you know, living up in Antarctica might see firewood. All right, so if it's inherently existent, then it would be the same thing to every single mind that viewed it. A little bit? Like I said, we got 15 minutes, man. They're going to cover this for years. I just want to try to touch on it. Okay. Let's go to okay, let's talk a little bit. I think Venerable Amy uses a car. Okay, so if you picture a car, I'm just going to keep throwing analogies at you, because sooner or later there's going to be a little touch that you're going to get a smidgen of it, and as long as we can just get that smidgen of it, then you'll be okay, because then you can follow it, okay, because there's a lot of books out there that are going to tell this a lot better than I can in these few minutes. Okay, so you have a car, all right, and you can point to a part of the car, okay, so let's say I'm pointing to the car and I'm pointing to the door, okay, and all of a sudden you start understanding, well, I'm not pointing at the car, I'm pointing at the door, I'm pointing at the door handle. Okay, where's the car? You can't point to a car That's a concept that we have. Because the car's parts. And not only is the car parts, it's got all these different parts. It's also there because of all the causes and conditions. From the workman that put it together to the guy that created it in the drawing room over at Hyundai or Kia or wherever. Okay, so there's causes and conditions. All the workmen that, you know, did the rubber for the wheels and everything. It's all of these parts. Causes and conditions, parts, and a labeling mind. All right, now, the other thing is talking about impermanence, too. That's another big word. Okay, so we look at this car, and we think that that car is really there, and that car is always going to be there. Okay, I just got this brand new car, and I love this new car, and that's my car. And nobody better touch my car, and I'm going to park out in left field because I don't want anybody to even scratch my car. Okay, and that first scratch, I'm devastated. Okay, why I think that car is going to last forever, I don't know. We all do that. We think that these things are going to last, but nothing lasts. There is nothing that is permanent either. Cars are not permanent. The stand is not permanent. Anybody sitting here is not permanent. We're not going to be here 100 years from now. Okay, these cushions are going to disintegrate. So, and then they'll go back to being those original parts and go on to something else. Okay, so impermanence and independent existence and dependent arisings. These are all some of these terminologies that help us to kind of get our brains wrapped around emptiness. Okay, and again, when we're saying emptiness, we're not saying nothingness. We're saying that we don't see things as they truly exist. Another really good analogy is that we've got this nice package, like a Christmas present here. Okay, and we tend to, instead of looking at what's inside that package, we tend to put the wrapping paper all as part of it. Instead of peeling back that wrapping paper to see what's in there, we just tend to look at this whole package of wrapper and entity in this thing all together. And if we take the labels off and start peeling back those layers and layers and layers to see what's really there. Okay? Anything? A little bit? You want to give it a shot? Question. Okay. Wait, let's do a question first. Okay, everything that we see in this world is a dependent arising.
Okay, I'm so confused. I don't even know what my question is.
Okay, go for it.
I think I get the analogy, like I could take a car apart, take the engine, and I could turn it into a lawnmower. I could make things, you know, it's not a car anymore now, it's a lawnmower.
Okay.
Am I right with that? I mean,
well, it's parts.
It's parts.
Sure.
And I labeled them,
parts.
And then I labeled it as something else.
Yep.
But, and I'm going to be blunt, why does this matter? I can't figure out where the pieces fall into place.
That's actually a great question. That's actually a really good question. Why does any of this matter? Okay? Why are we even here? Why does any of this matter? Go back there. Go ahead. Why are we doing this? Why does this matter?
I guess my immediate response about that is back to attachment. So if we are attached to the label, then we get distracted by the label. And if we're distracted by the label, then we kind of can't get to that growing place where we're getting towards Buddha and enlightenment and that.
That's actually a really good answer. It's just you're trying to learn how to work with your mind,
mm-hmm.
Okay, so that we can let some of these things go and work toward happiness. Okay?
It was basically about the same thing.
Basically about the same thing? Yeah. It is. That's a really good question. Why does this matter? That's really what we're here. Okay, why are we here? Why are we doing this? Why are we trying to listen to Sandy Carlson talk about emptiness? I mean, really. Okay? What we're trying to do is to find methods. We're all looking for different ways that we can potentially be happier people. And by being happier people, maybe we can be of more benefit to others. Okay? Now, part of what's hard to answer, you know, some of your question without saying anything, is that we're trying to work with our minds. We're trying to use our minds to work with our minds. And that is the hard part. Okay? It's just like we're trying to change the tire on our car when we're barreling 70 miles an hour down the freeway. We are trying to use our minds to learn about our minds. And that's very difficult. So these are just different concepts and different things that will try to help us get there. And we have to come at this a little bit sideways sometimes because we're very much like the monkey. We don't want to let go of things. Okay, you'll even hear monkey mind, elephant mind, things like that. Okay, so we have to come at these things a little bit sideways in order to work with the mind, use the mind to work with the mind. Chris.
I'm having a hard time with this whole emptiness and bodhicitta thing when I first started studying Buddhism. And one day, I'm laying up on the bed in our back upstairs bedroom. It's a warm day. I'm pretty sleepy. It's, you know, about 85 up there. And I went to get up to go downstairs, and I had this is going to sound spooky. It's almost going to sound like a testimony. I had this, like, little bitty brief understanding about how there's no part of what I think is me, what I perceive as me, that didn't come from some other sentient being. And I just, that kind of hooked together. That's why it's very important for me to think of every other sentient being as important, because that's the only reason that the parts of me are here. So I owe everything to them. And there's really nothing. See?
I understand.
I kind of, there's, my only existence is because of every other sentient being in the whole universe, because every one of those sentient beings is dependent on another sentient being, just like I perceive myself as being dependent on things that they provided. Like I read someplace once, every atom of your body right now has been through a worm.
That's some of that science stuff, yeah.
Right. But, you know, that kind of shows that
yep.
There's nothing really there that you think is for anything. It all is just parts and causes and conditions and dependent arising in your labeling mind. That, and that's one reason or one way that I kind of saw understanding of emptiness is important and ties it together with bodhicitta.
Yeah, that's actually really good. Part of what... Oh, Christian, go ahead.
One way that it... contemplating emptiness helps me is if I have a negative emotion that pops up about, say, someone, you know, comes to me and I get irritated by somebody about what they say or something like that. If I just stick with my label or stick with the story I tell myself about why I'm upset, it'll just stay there. I'll never get over it. I'll never have an opportunity to really understand why I'm actually feeling the way I feel. I'll just go ahead and place that label on there, slap it on there and say, that's why, and that's it. And I'm just mad at that person. That's the end of it. But when contemplating emptiness, I can kind of analyze my life, go backwards, and think about other times I felt that exact same way. Okay, why? What happened? Oh, it was because... And then I start to see all those different little pieces that come together. And so instead of being this concrete block or this concrete label, it is now, you break it apart. Just like if you have a big job to do, you get overwhelmed by this big giant task you have to complete because it's this big thing. But really, any big task is a bunch of little tasks that you have to get finished. And then before you know it, if you break it down in those little parts and work on those little things over a period of time, you've completed it. And I think that's how emptiness is for me. I have to break these things down. And when things come up and they're negative or even positive, to understand why do I feel that, and then that's where I feel it's helpful for me.
Yeah. So. And working on some of those things, okay, I like getting real specific because this really what Buddhism is all about is practical knowledge that can help you in everyday life, okay? This is one of the things that attracted me to it. These are things that actually, you know, it's not really a religion. It's more of a way of life every day, if we can. So working on what does this mean? Okay, let's just keep going down this because it helps. It helps you to look at things. A lot of times when we talk about attachment and aversion, whether positive or negative, okay, you tend to hang around with the people that make you feel good, okay, and you tend to try to avoid the people that make you feel bad for whatever reason. But if you ever really stop and look at it, and again, part of the way that I can do this is just by relating some of my own experiences, okay, many times when something's going wrong, you know, we tend to blame out there. It's his fault. It's her fault. They did this. They did that to me. When you really start working with Buddhism, you tend to take the victim mentality out of it. You start to look at yourself and you start to think about it. And if what's really hard, okay, especially for me, is you have to be that really, really honest and look at it. Okay, why am I so upset? So sometimes if something goes wrong, I'll go sit on the cushion and I'll start going through it. Why am I so upset? And I start doing exactly what you're saying, Chris. I start breaking it down. Okay, it's this, it's this. I start actually looking inside. Why is this? And I'll usually come up with, you know what? It's bumped up against my pride. It's bumped up against something inside me, a fault in me, that that's why I'm bothered by it, because they certainly don't care. They're off, you know, having dinner with their family or whatever. And it's nothing. You know, and most of us do that. We get mad at something and we move on. Well, we don't hang on it, but the person that is on the receiving end hangs on it and becomes attached to it and has that monkey grasp to it. And that's us. So be on that receiving end. Then I start to work with it. And why? And many times I'll just break it down and I'll find something within me that I can work with. And you really do realize just how empty some of that stuff is, because it's that story that I told. It's that projection that I put out there, because it certainly wasn't out there. I put it out there. Okay, so that's that learning to work with it a little bit and to just sit with it. And how do you apply it? And how do you make this something that is going to help you? Because that's what part of this is. It's that daily help. It's not so much of a, you know, I think we tend to do this with all religions, whether it's Buddhism or Christianity or anything like that. You know, the lay people, you know, it's like, oh, that's on Sunday, you know. And it's not. It's not just one day of the week. This is something we try to work with every day. And I think every major faith tries to put that across to us, but we don't pick it up that well. Even the word Kadampa, Kadampa Center. Kadampa means one who takes the Buddhist teachings personally, as a personal practice. All right, so we try to work with this stuff every day, but we have to, why are we trying to do it? We want to be happier. We want to find ways to help. We want to be good people. And so why does this stuff matter? Because it helps us to make the space in our minds so we can learn. Make some space within our minds, because, again, we're working with our minds. We're trying to use our minds to learn about our minds. And we just, if we can touch on some of these concepts. Again, emptiness is something that years and years of study. There's books out there, 7-6-week programs that you can take, and you're still going to get just a touch. But even if you get that touch and you experience just that moment, like Chris talked about, okay, then that's that teaser that will keep you going. At least it works for me that way. What's that? Absolutely.
So I was just thinking of that, the way Venerable Amy, the explanation she uses, and I think it ties a lot of this together really well, and I'm going to try as much as I can to remember the way she explains it, because she puts it together really well, and it really ties together a lot of the things that all the comments, what Chris said, what you said, Christian, what everybody said. So, and I'll try to keep it quick, too.
All right.
So, which, you know, as Sandy mentioned, Venerable Amy uses the analogy of a car, but we can use this whiteboard too, right? So, right now I'm pointing at, you all agree I'm pointing at the whiteboard, right? But what am I actually pointing at? Well, I'm pointing at the middle of the white part of the whiteboard, right? I'm pointing at a spot on the middle of the white part of the whiteboard. So that, what I'm actually pointing at is not the whiteboard itself. The whiteboard, it's a part of the whiteboard. So there are a bunch of parts here, right? There's the frame, there's the white part, there are the wheels, and this is all together. So it's kind of easy to see. It's not very difficult to see that this is a collection of parts, right? Everybody agree with that? You can kind of see the collection of parts. So on this collection of parts, we place a label, whiteboard. Whiteboard is really just a label. There's no one part of this that contains the whiteboardness, right? It's just a label that we're used to, we're accustomed to by habit or by, you know, whatever you want to call it. We're accustomed to calling this a whiteboard. It's just what we're all used to calling it in English. In strict Buddhist terms, we could say we have the karma to perceive this as a whiteboard, but we can just keep it simple and say we're used to calling it that by habit. So, and the fact that whiteboard is a label that we're placing on this, that's really important because, like Sandy said, you know, you could have somebody who comes out of the Amazon jungle and they see this and they don't see the markers and they don't know you can write on it. They just see firewood or they see a wall that they can put on their house. And that, to us, it seems silly, but that label wall or that label firewood is as real to them and as genuine and as accurate to them as whiteboard is to us. Is everybody kind of following that? Okay. So why is this important? That's the real question. Where are we getting with this? So the problem is that what we do instinctively is we see the parts, and then we place that label on the parts, whiteboard, but instantly we merge the label and the parts, and we don't see them as separate. We see that label, whiteboard, as coming from the whiteboard, not as a label we're placing on it. And then we react to that. So maybe this is the whiteboard that I just bought for Kadampa Center. This is my big contribution to the center this year, and I walk by it, and I see, and I say, yeah, that's me being generous. So what that means is I have attachment towards it, right? It makes me feel good. It's supporting some good feeling I have about myself. Or maybe I see that and I think about, you know, my third grade teacher who was really mean and made me write 100 times, I will not chew gum in class on it. So I have this negative connotation that makes me feel bad about myself when I see a whiteboard, right? What I see, so this is when we say attachment and aversion arise. It's that feeling that I have because of that label. But again, I experience that feeling as coming from the thing, not as something that I'm putting on it. So we have the object, we have the label that we place on the object, then we have a feeling of attachment or aversion based on that label. And all of our other negative, non-virtuous states of mind arise from that label and those feelings. And that's why you'll hear people when they talk about emptiness, they say when you really understand it, not just intellectually, but when you really feel it, when it goes to your heart and you get an actual experience of this and you look at everything and see it this way, that's what cuts the root of all our suffering. So that's the whole reason we've been talking these 5 weeks. This is kind of what it all comes down to. And everything else we're trying to do here is that's kind of why emptiness is such an important topic, because what we're trying to do here is trying to understand all these concepts intellectually and meditate on them and get to a point where you actually experience things that way. Because when you experience things that way, when you see things the way they really are, you're not going to suffer anymore. You're not going to experience that suffering in those non-virtuous states of mind. So that's as much as I can stick with the way Venerable Amy explains it. But that's kind of, that's where it all goes.
That's it. That's it. Experiential. Because once you experience it, you don't forget it. Intellectual knowledge, book learning, you can forget, okay? And we all know that because how many of us went to high school or college? I can't remember a thing about geometry anymore, okay? But I studied it for a long time. But you can forget that. But experiences and feelings, we do remember that. So it's almost once you get that, you can't go back. And that's kind of where this is at, just kind of living with it. Yes, ma'am.
Just a question. This can almost relate to yourself.
Absolutely.
Because
yes.
I'm beginning to realize that energy scientifically never disappears.
Correct.
Basically, that's what we are particles of energy from possibly other beings. So we have to look at ourselves as you're looking at the blackboard.
Mm-hmm. Yes. That's it. Absolutely.
So for us to look that way, we need to erase the negative and only put out positive because we're releasing that energy.
That's a good way to look at it, yeah. You can.
Is that assertive on the right track?
Yep, it's very close to the right track. All of this does absolutely relate to us, to each one of us. Okay, we've been using the whiteboard, we've been using cards, we've been using flowers, and that's all true, okay? Because everything is dependent arising, everything,
so,
including each of us.
Because it's hard to explain, but when you look at yourself, you have to realize that you're really not Chris. You're accumulation of many things. Is that right?
Yeah.
And Chris,
yes. And Chris,
exactly,
is a label.
Yeah, I'm beginning to
Scott
think
is
that
a label.
Label we're very attached to.
Yep.
Just a
label.
Okay. And everything, and this is kind of, okay, this is kind of where karma and emptiness come together. Okay? A little bit of this is where those two things come together. Okay? Because this is, and it's for each one of us, okay? Sandy has all of this karma that is coming with, that is causing these things, or it's, you know, you can almost say that that's throwing my projections out in front of me to see. And I can't remember if that was Venerable Amy who did that?
Rubina.
Venerable Rubina, yeah. Okay. So the karma that's propelling Sandy through this life, okay, it's almost like it's throwing this projection out and the Sandy movie is going on, okay, and there's the causes and conditions to have this, the causes and conditions to have this, okay, and this is where I'm trying to work on Sandy, okay, and try to do the virtuous things that I can do to start to lose some of this negativity and remove some of these obstacles and obscurations and work on the positive so I can generate good karma and wonderful merit, okay, so that next, you know, because I'm the keeper of this mind, this subtle mind, and I would like to be able to pass this off to the next carrier, the next bearer of this subtle mind, with as much good as I can possibly do. Everything. And it's mind moments. Yeah. But when you start to actually get that, when you start to actually work with that, okay, and understand that, you know, things are empty, and it's what you can control that. So this is where that person, you know, that this is why you see people with cancer that are not totally depressed and unhappy. This is why you see rich people that are devastated and very depressed. Because where are you looking? What's going on? You can control those things to the best of your ability if you study it. Is this making sense? Yeah. You have the ability to work with your mind, and you have the ability to change your mind, and you have the ability to be happier no matter what's going on out there. No matter what's going on out there.
The first time we were here, you talked about the earth.
That's the Buddha. That's when he touched the earth, yes.
But there has to be balance.
Yeah.
So when you lose that sense of balance,
yep,
you go back to the earth to realize that you're just,
yep,
almost insignificant,
yeah,
in a way. Is,
yeah,
it just a momentary existence and we're trying to pass on what positivity that we have to others? That's what this is all about?
A momentary existence?
We're just here for a short time.
We're here for a short time. We're here for a very precious time, and we don't know how long we are here for. Okay? That's you know, one of those things about the Buddhists is death is definite. Death, you have no idea when it's going to happen. Okay? So you could have, you know, so many years, or, you know, you might have 85, 95 years. So there's all kinds of, again, little, you know what, I can't believe we ran out of time like this. We are not going to get to anything else. Okay. Let's just stop. Are there any other major questions? Because, I mean, we really, this is it. I can't believe this. I didn't put my little clock down here. All right. Let's do next steps. If anyone is would like to do more, you want to find out some more about Buddhism or some of these different classes, you can go onto the Kadampa Center website and find out much more information. The next class, and I don't have the dates on me right now, but there's a Meditation 101 class, which will again be a 5 or 6 week course that will either be on Tuesday or Thursday night, depending on the teacher. I don't know who's going to be teaching that, either David or Karen or Jill, even. I'm not sure who's teaching it. But Buddhism, in a nutshell, alternates with Meditation 101. Okay? And Meditation 101 will go into much more meditation techniques than what we were able to do here. Okay? And that, too, will go from 7 to 8:30 once a week for 5 or 6 weeks. Okay? And just check on the calendar, and you'll see when that starts again. That's a great class, even if you've been meditating for a long time, to just come on in and check on. It's a good refresher course, and again, it will go through a lot of the meditations that we did and others in much more detail. Monday nights, we have Discovering Buddhism, and that is a 2-year course, and it comes in 14 different modules. Is anybody here going to DB? Trying? Okay, Buddhism, or Discovering Buddhism. That's the 2-year course that happens on Monday nights. Okay, and there's 14 different modules. I think that they're on module 5 right now, 5 or 6. I think that they're on death. They're on 7? Okay, death and rebirth? Steve? Okay. A death and rebirth class. It sounds like a depressing class, and it's actually not, okay? Again, Buddhists take a totally different view on it. Stephanie Smith is teaching that class. She's a phenomenal practitioner, a many, many year practitioner, and that class is 3rd or 4th, you know, maybe halfway through. You can pop in and out of DB as you will, okay? Even though it's starting about the middle right now, it will just cycle through, okay? Little mini courses. There's a certification if you'd like to complete the whole course. Then there's a certification available with that. There is a CD out there that has all of the Discovering Buddhism classes, the writings, the readings, and then there's additional books to read if you're interested. That's a phenomenal class. It's taught by different long-term students here at the center, and it's great for more deep diving on some of the things that we were only able to cover in just a little short synopsis here. Wednesday nights, Geshe-la teaches a class on the Lam Rim. Okay, as step-by-step how to get enlightened, and that's exactly what we're talking about here. Now, it's a little bit not so much of a beginner course, and the reason that I say that is because they don't do a lot of explanation, because a lot of the students that are in that class have been practitioners for a while, so they understand the concepts. We understand these, so there's not a lot of explanation of them, but I'm not dissuading you from stepping in and going, because we're going page by page through the actual Lam Rim Chenmo book. And it's nothing that you couldn't catch up on, or something that you couldn't do some extra reading to figure out what they mean when we're going through this. So that's a phenomenal class. That's on Wednesday nights. Sundays, there are 2 sessions on Sundays. There's a 9 o'clock session and a 10:45 session. And Sundays are taught by Geshe Gelchoda, again, our resident teacher. He does a little bit of meditation, and then he talks in very broad concepts about happiness, how to become, and like just things that we can do. And he keeps it very, very general and basic, because we have people here that come here of all faiths, all different cultures, and all different levels. Okay, so Sundays are easily available to anybody that would like to come. We have different rituals and different prayer groups. You'll see things like pujas and different practices that you'll see. You're welcome to come to almost anything here at the center. There's only a few things, and they'll be very specific if you need some kind of prerequisite for the class. But otherwise, feel free to come to anything that we've got here. And there are many, many teachers, and many of the Sangha. We have 2 Geshe's here. Geshe, again, is the title like doctorate. Okay, and then we also have 2 Western nuns here, Venerable Chuki and Venerable Lamo. Okay, and both of them are always open to questions if you would like to ask anything. Sarah Brooks is also our spiritual program assistant, our director, and if you've got questions, you can also reach her at programs@kadampacenter.com. What questions might you have, or is there anything else that I can do to help her answer anything that you've got? Nothing? All right. Then let's take a moment to dedicate these awesome efforts that y'all have made for whatever reason you came here, whether it was just curiosity or whether you wanted to find out a little bit more about how to be a happier person to benefit others. It's all good. It's all good, and we just dedicate all of these efforts to the enlightenment and compassion for all beings. So thank you so much for coming.